Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. Today, another international break and another chance for this England side to state their core brand values. Capable against weak opposition, quite good at scoring goals, not quite right in central midfield. A wonderful football cocktail. Wales, meanwhile, have discovered they're much better when players from Real Madrid and Juventus are available for them, but it's less exciting for Scotland and Northern Ireland, who will have to rely on the playoffs to make the Euros. Plus, a Premier League preview featuring a potential barnstormer in Manchester and an excellent and well-attended weekend in the WSL. Let's take you now into the audio recording facility where I'm joined, as usual, by Mina Rizuki. How are you, Mina?
Yeah, I'm having one of those forgetful mornings.
Oh, no.
You know, forgot my party. I had to walk back and get it. It was, yeah. It's been a long morning.
Is it a little bit difficult for you to relinquish the hosting chair? I wasn't here last week. We sat in this actual chair.
Yes, I actually even specifically asked for it.
Good.
Because Matt was trying to steal it. And well, I was like, no, you're absolutely not having that. And it's so much fun being on there that I'm like, you know, I don't know, Tom. Yeah, I feel like we should switch.
I do sit on a throne in the audio. Well, you did a fantastic job, Mina. Thank you very much. Alongside her, it's Sam Dean, the boy wonder. How are you, Sam?
I'm good. I'm back in the game. I've been out for, a month or so? So
yeah,
it's an honour to return.
Absolutely. How about you, JJ? Are you feeling honoured to be here?
Yes. We played football yesterday. We lost 7-2, but it was a lot closer
than
that
seems. That's an improvement.
We're getting a lot better.
Good.
Lot better.
Speaking of thrashings, which were closer than they sound, what about England through to the Euro 2020 tournament? Top of their group. Quite a poor game against Kosovo. 4-0. A little bit harsh on the home side in the end, JJ.
Yeah. I mean, all the goals came at the very end in a kind of a barrage after Kosovo had... I think they did quite well to hold them back. They pressed really high up the pitch when they could, then they dropped into a block and let England play out. And then Declan Rice would just put it backwards or lose it. I'm not sure he is the answer to their holding midfielder role. I thought Callum Hudson-Odoi got a lot of harsh press. Cause I don't think he... I mean, he was trying to get involved, but the ball was rarely on his side. But I can't work out whether that's because Raheem Sterling was usually on the opposite wing and the play was going through him most of the time, or because he needs to try and get involved. But if he tries to get involved, then he leaves his position vacant and then he loses shape. So what's he meant to do?
Yeah, yeah, tricky for Callum. What about Kosovo, Mina? I feel a bit sad Kosovo aren't going to be with us for Euro 2020. They gave England a couple of good games.
I know, I thought they were actually the most exciting team to watch, to be frank. Also because they're just not a side that's sort of willing to be like, all right, we're very bad, so we're going to try to defend and see what we can do. They actually try to play enterprising football. And it's fun to see. I thought, like, I almost felt like it was a bit weird, like, how grateful they were in the way that, you know, like, the whole thing was hosted. It was like, thank you, England, and we love you, England. It was almost like...
There's some historical context for that. Am I right? I
think yeah, it is, you know, the way that England sort of rescued them from, I guess, what they felt were the advances of Serbia.
Different podcast, very different podcast.
Yeah, probably. I'm not very good with this stuff. So, but either way, they are I still think they have a slim chance of getting through. But if they had better finishes, then I feel like they would have really given England a good game and, you know, shocked them a lot more and perhaps even come second in the group.
Are they in a shake-up with the Nations League and the playoffs?
Mm-hmm. They're in the playoffs.
Ah, okay.
I think.
That's good.
Still
we may still have our Kosovo fun across the continent next year.
I don't
year.
Think Kosovo are as great as I've seen a lot of people write. They seem to because I know they had a good run of games where they kept winning, but they're not actually all that.
Is the point not that they're just far better than they should be given their resources?
Probably, but I think, I mean, they are where they should be in the group.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think the way they play and the fact that they are so young as a footballing nation and as a nation in general, and the whole vibe around it makes it quite a nice story, which is probably why they're getting that PRU reference.
Two Spurs players on the score sheet, Sam, Kane and Winks. Do you think they're enjoying their time with England more than they are with their club at the moment?
It looks like it. Harry Winks certainly seemed to be enjoying a more advanced midfield position yesterday. He was excellent. I thought he was probably England's best player and rightly sort of been hailed this morning by all the papers and all the journalists who were there. He was also very good last week in a holding role. So I think he's probably come out best of anyone from this this international break. I'm not entirely convinced he's the man to play the holding role against better teams, simply because there's a defensive responsibility there, which he's not necessarily the best at doing compared to someone like Declan Rice, who is more tackle you and win the ball back kind of vibe. But the way he controls play, the way he dictates the tempo, I think was really encouraging for England, and getting his first goal was nice. And
the first touch for that is so
stunning.
Good.
Yeah.
Like, so really underrated.
Bit worried about the central defender there. Is that harsh?
He's turned inside out. He's gone the wrong way. He's off balance. He turns around and knows he's done. I think that's why he stops.
Then, then he's gone, I know I'm done. Yeah. I'm not going to bother even chasing this.
See, everyone else is like, oh, that's nice. Yeah, he's in. Yeah.
But I was surprised that they played with a double pivot. I was just like, you know, a little bit like, why don't you just go crazy in this and just have like England?
They played with one. It was a 4-1-4-1.
England, as in why Rice and sort of Harry Winks, like why not put Mason Mount from the start, basically?
Well, they put Winks in that Mount role.
Yeah,
so and allowed to. The left of Rice,
but Mount is a little bit more creative, a little bit more.
It's more of a 10, but they're playing that 4-1-4-1. It means you've got two diamonds to the middle of the pitch and your wide players can stretch the play. It seems to work really well for them. It's a little bit of a change from what he's been doing. It's a lot more like what Leicester have. That's why Rice, you always see it when they're out of possession, it's always 4-1-4-1. And then the wide guys go up top and make a 3.
Do you think it should be Rice who starts?
I do not, but I don't know really who goes there, because I agree with Sam about Harry Winks. I think he's a nice, tidy player, really brave on the ball, shows for it, always looks for it, and you need that in your team. But I mean, I think there must be a reason why he's put Rice in against Kosovo, and he had Winks in that same role in the game against... Who's their team they beat? Montenegro. Yeah, because you know you're going to have more of the ball against Montenegro. Yeah.
And they're a much weaker team.
Yeah, and Kosovo, although they'll press you high, you want to have someone who's back who can deal with... Because, I mean, they got caught out... actually, like, the goals that they conceded against Kosovo in the 5-3, and a couple of them are Rice's fault in the first place. He played that holding role there again, yeah.
That's why I was wondering. I'm like, do you need necessarily... I'm trying to think of who I would play instead of Rice, but because I don't feel like he's been amazing for England so far. But no. I do think that I know what you mean by his type of who he is as a player, is the right player to put in that midfield to allow for the others to sort of go forward. But
I mean, Henderson, maybe? He might be the one that goes in there.
He doesn't play there for Liverpool anymore.
No, he's sort of ball winning. Yeah, he goes forward. There's a few teams that have a really good holding player. Like Holland have like Frankie de Jong, for example. Yeah. But there's a few teams in world football. Like Sergio Busquets is still there. But it's hard to find them. I'm not sure England have one just now.
Yeah. Eric Dier.
No.
The lost Eric Dier.
No.
Back to 2016. what about England as a whole? The job was very much done with the 7-0 victory against Montenegro earlier in the week. Awful opponents, but a good sign, I think, that England had recovered from that blip against the Czech Republic, that unexpected defeat to them. How do we assess the team as a whole? It seems pretty clear that defence is the problem for England. If everyone plays to their potential in midfield and attack, there's plenty to go at there, plenty of goals in the team. Is there a path between now and the tournament starting, Mina, where England can find a capable international tournament challenging defence, do you think?
Well, I think that what's interesting is that you sort of kind of know who's going to play in your attack. You know there's going to be definitely Sterling, you definitely know it's going to be Kane and probably going to be Rashford. But when it comes to defence, you kind of have no idea. Is it going to be Trent Alexander-Arnold? Is it going to be Kieran Trippier? Who's going to be your centre-backs? Is Stones going to come in? Is Tyrone Mings? You know, obviously you feel like Harry Maguire is the only one who's got his position nailed down. And I think because of the instability there and the fact that there's still that problem when it comes to how they change in the transitional phase to try to block counterattacks. Counterattacks are still a problem. And you just feel as soon as they lose possession, it's a problem. And they need to find a sort of stability at the back, have a clear understanding there. I don't think Keane is perhaps the right person to put there. I think I do really like Mings. I think that he works so well at the back, but, you know, it's up to Southgate to find his proper back line and just allow that to allow them to foster and fluidity and understanding between them. And maybe that will change things. But I do sort of look around, and I know there's a lot of criticism about the defence, and I do think it's a problem. But I look around and I just feel like when it comes to this Europe qualifiers, I haven't seen many teams that have been that good defensively either. So just go all out of tag.
Bring Keegan back. Just we'll score more than you.
But if you go and score, I mean, you are going to leave gaps if you win games 7-0 and 4-0 and stuff like that. Like, that's just a natural consequence, right?
Absolutely.
So being vulnerable to counterattack is purely a consequence of of numbers. It's like numerical people, the amount of people they have going at you, you're going to be caught out. And the goals they conceded when in the 5-3 were mistakes, individual errors, and the penalty. And well, when they lost to Czech Republic, it's probably sort of a similar thing, right? I think, they're saying Tyrone Mings looks like a really good player because he's just hardy and gets rid, right? And you kind of want that sometimes because they're trying to play out from the back. But you've got to think about things like when Trent Alexander-Arnold plays on the right, he's so high and wide. You saw it against Kosovo constantly. He's so high like a winger, like he does for Liverpool. And you see that with Andy Robertson at Scotland as well. They're so used to playing that high that they need to play with someone behind them to the side.
Who's willing to drop back.
It's not that they're willing to drop back. It's that they know when they're going to do it and they know it to cover that space and when. It's something that they must work on a lot in training with Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool, because that's so... A lot of fullbacks play like that. Play high, but not as high as Alexander-Arnold, and then maybe Trippier is a little bit deeper, so that's a bit safer. But then you need someone else who can stretch to play on the right. It's just so many. Every single choice you make has a knock-on effect.
But it really is about if you can just get the midfield, sort of the outside midfield, to know how to sort of get them to understand what the fullback is going to do in their movements, and maybe help in that defensive lineup.
But
is then, that what you
but
think?
They would always start wide to give you width, and then if they start that wide, they can come inside a wee bit. I'm not sure. That's just purely in build-up. Like, it depends if you're out of possession or in, because then they have different positions depending on the phase of play and where the ball is.
Have you got any solutions, JJ? Do you look at that defence and think, I'm bringing this guy in,
I don't think
I'm going to make
bad.
Them play like that? Okay.
I saw this
that's
question,
good.
And I don't understand. I don't see where it comes from. Like, I like the way that Southgate's making them play forward, and they're enjoying it, and you can see they're enjoying playing.
They're error-prone, though, aren't they? And that... Is that a mentality thing, do you think, perhaps?
But individual mistakes, like error prone, I think, is things like Declan Rice giving the ball away and they counter you high up the pitch and that's how they score. And I think that's something you can't really coach out of someone. You don't want them to get rid, you want them to keep playing the ball. But you need them to have confidence and be brave to keep showing for it. So it's good that they're doing that. What you need to think is, I think Mina's right, they need to have a stable line, because then you grow used to each other and get partnerships. That's why a lot of national teams will use club partnerships at the back, because that helps you kind of... They have an understanding, but the whole team is what defends. It's not just one player in a back line.
The problem with what you're saying, Tom, about let's just go get him all out attack sort of thing, win 4-3, is that that very rarely works in tournaments. And if you look at the last 20 years, the teams that have won tournaments, probably with the exception of Brazil in 2002 and maybe Germany 2014, although I think they were still pretty built on a solid core, is that these teams are first and foremost
grinders,
defensively grinding.
Portugal, Greece,
look at the four semi-finalists in Russia: England, Croatia, France, Belgium. France had the best defence and France won, and I think Spain had the best defence when they won three tournaments in a row.
Like, Germany won it for me because of the fact that they knew how to control the ball in midfield. So they know how to, there's a difference in sometimes, like, for example, Kevin De Bruyne is a really great player, like, just, you know, for Manchester City, but you feel like sometimes he has this urge to keep pushing forward, to keep trying to break the lines, when sometimes all you need to do is just maybe fall deeper, just keep the ball and then wait so that you can create your triangles or whatever it is. I feel like that's what the difference is with Germany, was that they had Kroos and Khedira. They had that ability to control midfield. You have Kante, you have players, for example, in France as well, who know how to hold possession when the time comes. I think that's what we need to have necessarily. Or if you are going to lose possession, make sure you lose it perhaps somewhere where it's not so easily to quickly counterattack in a vertical fashion.
When you say we, you mean England, right?
Yeah, sorry, I do mean England. I feel like that's where your midfield needs to exert that kind of control to sort of shore up the defence.
And that's what England's never really had at tournaments.
Exactly.
But also that point you make about Germany as well, this is a bit slightly as an aside, but I was reading Per Mertesacker's book recently, and he said that in the 2014 World Cup, Mesut Ozil's job, he was told, your whole job is to keep the ball. when the team's under pressure, just pass it to Mesut and he'll just keep the ball.
It's what Modric did against England when it was all like, you know, because obviously England are so like ferocious when they go forward. He just knew which space to occupy and he just kept the ball and kept filling the spaces. And I was like, that intellect of a midfielder like that can actually change the game.
We have to rake over the old coals of Raheem Sterling versus Joe Gomez. We've not had a podcast since that all blew up. It's one of the oldest football cliches, Sam, that these things happen every day at training grounds up and down the country. You spend a fair bit of time at Arsenal. Have you ever seen anything like this? Is it true, the cliche, that players are constantly fighting with each other?
I think there are naturally clashes between egotistical, testosterone-fueled, sometimes unintelligent men, quite often. I think lots of teammates don't like each other. I think that's a fact of life and the fact of any office or of any workplace. My personal view, based on everything I've read, know, been told, et cetera, is that this sort of thing happens quite often. What was odd about the Sterling-Gomez thing is that it was 24 hours after the actual incident. So normally you'd think going home and sleeping on it would, you know, ease your mind, and then Sterling's come back in the next day, travelled all the way there to St George's Park, and he's still fuming enough to do that.
I suppose it was only the Sunday night game, wasn't it? It's not an enormous amount of time to get over something.
Result, but you understand sort of tempers flare and, you know, heat of the moment, see the red, etc. But a day later feels a bit odd to me. That feels like that was what struck me the most, that he's been simmering on this for a whole 24 hours and didn't think, I'm going to not do something, chose to act upon it, which I find very bizarre.
Do you think Southgate handled it in the best way, JJ? Did it need to be dealt with publicly in the way it was, or could it have been settled internally?
It feels like they're trying to be so open with the press that maybe the best way for him to have dealt with it is the way he did it, because it follows his current strategy. And I mean, it makes sense. Everyone knows about it anyway. It stops you having all these weird Twitter rumors and WhatsApp group messages coming around and fake chats. It makes sense to me.
Not to me.
No.
I say this as a journalist. It's a great story, and it made a great week worth of story. You know, it was brilliant, because it was plenty of things to talk about, and we're talking about it now still. But from a pure PR perspective, I don't see why he had to chuck Sterling out of the team, which made it a massive deal, and then, as we then saw, led to Joe Gomez being booed for reasons no one can quite understand.
Do you have any reasons, Mina? Why was Gomez booed at Wembley?
Because this is going to go into a rant, so I was trying to, like, you know, save myself. Because, so what if you're booed? Like, as in, you know, like, I mean, everything that I read. But it was all like, Joe was devastated. I get it. He's young and he doesn't understand what he's done wrong. But life's not fair, you know, like, and I feel like everything that's written about this, you know, like, Sterling, firstly, is considered alongside Harry Kane, the only world-class player that England have. And that's what everyone keeps feeding us. And people are probably a little bit loyal to that. So, you know, they'd rather keep Sterling happy than anyone else happy. I don't know what the reasons are. People just boo. You know, Di Stefano was booed at Real Madrid. Some of the greatest players, Lampard was booed. Like, this happens in football. And my feeling about all of this with England is that this constant, like, you know, like, oh, it's not fair. And this poor kid, and how are we going to get through this? You know, like, how many teams are pelted with tomatoes, or are sent bullets in the post, or have their lives threatened or dropped for no reason just because, you know, I don't know. Like, Casillas basically lost out on his Real Madrid career because he called up some of his Barcelona teammates and was like, guys, let's try to put the country before our, you know, club rivalry. Every day, you know, you looked at Piqué and Sergio Ramos having to play in that back line, and you knew that they didn't like each other. You knew that Spain was like a little bit of a mess because Jose Mourinho had come in and tried to make a mess. They still won the Euros in 2008, the World Cup in 2010, the Euros in 2012. I just feel like these things don't really matter. They don't deserve the airtime. And the fact that everyone is feeling all this, like, oh, this is so sad, you know, like, poor Joe, is Sterling going to recover from this? What about our group? If you're not used to this type of, like, criticism aimed at you, then I'm not sure you can cut it at the highest level when you're playing a final.
It's sad when your partner's at the game, though, is it not? Like, I think I'm right in saying that Gomez's partner and possibly his kid was at Wembley to see that. Like, it's a shame that had to happen.
And this wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been made public. I mean, it would have come out. It would have come out, because that's what happens. JJ's right, it would have come out. To make it as big a deal, it was an issue which could have been dealt with internally and come out publicly and said, yeah, this happened, it's fine, we're getting over it. To chuck Sterling out of the team for that game, heightened this and made it a massive deal. It turned it from a one-day story into a five-day story.
It did
from
a PR perspective. It does also put the team first, though, and I can see why he's done it, because then you're trying to build a team and a togetherness in the squad, and if Sterling stepped out of line, we weren't in that. It was cafeteria meant to have happened, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So we weren't there when it happened, so you don't know exactly what it was. Maybe it just was really out of order, and you go, "Well, do you know what? Like, you're not playing. You're on a naughty step for this, and it sets a precedent because you can't lose control of the, of, you know, your discipline. Make sure that he's the authoritarian there. And football fans are just often think independently.
Yeah, I've got a theory about this, which is quite simple. People just really like booing. It's really fun to do it. Go on.
Well, you just did it to me.
Yeah. Okay, you've had your.
Didn't Kane say that they decided on it as a group when he was doing his post-match interview yesterday? They were like, you know, what would you feel about Sterling's love? And he was saying, you know, we decided as a group that, you know, he's not going to play the game. So I just feel like it wasn't necessarily. Am I the only one ever?
It's very.
I'm not sure if
it's
just Southgate's decision. And my point is that there are lots of really controversial points in football. For example, Solskjaer being asked about the penalty takers. But when Lampard was asked about the fact that, you know, who is your penalty taker? Is it Ross Barkley? Is it Jorginho? He was like, well, it was Ross Barkley, now it's Jorginho. End of story. He just refuses to, like, indulge anyone. Whereas Solskjaer is always like, well, I mean, firstly, I think it's up to them. And you know, like, when it comes to this type of thing, like, I would like, I don't want to judge. Southgate is perfect and he's done everything. And I agree with JJ. Like, I think this is the way that he thought was the best way to handle it. But sometimes it's a bit like, don't give the press what they're looking for. Don't give the storylines. Don't give people reasons to boo a player who doesn't want to have that on his first game or whatever it is after the you know, that huge match against Manchester City. But otherwise, I just feel like you have to swallow these types of things because this is what happens at international level.
It's a very easy thing to do to drop somebody from Montenegro at home when you're pretty much already qualified.
Yeah.
If, for example, Harry Kane gets annoyed in training ahead of the European Championships quarterfinal and swings an elbow and catches John Stones in the face and it's seen as a malicious thing, is Southgate going to say, well, you know, that's the precedent. Kane, you're out. Well, obviously, he's not.
I think the precedent's pretty clear, Sam. Boo John Stones.
Yes. But it's basically, as Mina was saying, it's essentially just a PR com story, which is, thankfully for Southgate, it was only the second worst PR decision of the week.
Hi, I'm Katie Morley and I'm the Telegraph's consumer champion. It's a big job title, but what it really means is that I help readers who are being ripped off. I've heard from scam victims, people whose insurance won't pay up, readers who've been on horrendous holidays or been fleeced by car hire firms. You name it, I've dealt with it. And I've managed to win back over £800,000 for our readers in less than 6 months. It's not always easy, though. I've spent hours on the phone arguing with companies and stepped in where the police refused. And time, as we all know, means money. That's where our subscribers come in. If you subscribe to The Telegraph, you're helping fund public service journalism like this, as well as great podcasts like the one you're listening to. So, if you'd like to help support what we're doing and get unlimited access to the huge range of world-class journalism, head to telegraph.co.uk/audio. You can get 30 days free access to The Telegraph online, and after that it's just £2 a week. That's telegraph.co.uk/audio, or click on the link in the show notes to this episode.
Let's move on to the rest of the European qualifiers now, JJ. Scotland came from behind to beat Cyprus. Win on Tuesday?
Not tonight, which is Monday.
Correct.
Yeah.
A win on Tuesday would be 3 on the spin. Is this it? Are they improving? Could the impossible happen? Could we see them at Euro 2020?
No.
Oh, no.
That's fine. Like, it's going to take some time. And the problem is with Scotland is that it's a little bit like England in that we always need to have Scotland always need to rebuild.
You can say we.
I know.
Come on. Mina's already done
it. All right. Well,
yeah. Nailed our colours to the mast.
Always need to rebuild. And then it starts to go, towards the end of the tenure of someone's management, like Gordon Strachan, for example, everyone starts going, we need to change. This is not good enough. But the results actually are getting better. And then they get change it and chop. And someone else comes in. Steve Clark did amazing things at Kilmarnock, like he really did, and it will take him time to get the players there. The players just aren't, they're missing really important players in important positions. There's no clear goal scorer, there's no goalkeeper. The defence is So the game against Cyprus, you had Scott McKenna, who's Aberdeen's star defender. He will probably be playing in England at some point quite soon. He's very talented, but he's been poor this year. And he got turned inside out by Cyprus players who I've not heard of. Like, really easy, like, turning in by the end of the box. Pretty poor. Declan Gallagher plays for Motherwell. He's done very well and deserved a chance in the team, but just didn't look up to it. The midfield, you've got players like John McGinn, very talented. You know, Ryan Christie is a proper star player. James Forrest is also a really good player, but they're missing something, and it seems a bit disorganised, and there's so many people who call out, that come out of the team, like we were missing Scott McTominay, you had Ryan Fraser, Andrew Robertson all pulled out, Liam Cooper as well. So there's players that just desperately in need of like a right back and all these sorts of things that we don't have. And I think the playoff that will happen, so the Nations League playoff, we will probably get drawn against either Israel or Bulgaria is quite likely. And I think, having watched Bulgaria, Scotland should pump them. I'm not sure about Israel. But then it's only one leg games that you play. And then the final would be against either Norway or Serbia. And ooh, there's no way.
I was like, oh, I think you can beat Israel and Bulgaria. But then, yeah.
And the thing with Scotland is that they will find a way to get to the final and be 1-0 up. And heroically, brave Scotland, throw it away.
What about brave Wales, Sam? They have an important match against Hungary also on Tuesday. A win will get them through to Euro 2020. We were a little bit scathing about Ryan Giggs's reign so far on this podcast previously on an international break. How do you rate his performance at the moment?
Picked up dramatically in the last month, I suppose. Yeah, month, last 5 weeks, 6 weeks. There have been, I think, fairly criticisms of Giggs's approach. I mean, for a long time, well, until basically last month, there was a real lack of any sort of defined playing style. Essentially, it was throw the young kids in and see what happens, which didn't really work in the games that mattered, and Wales basically didn't really look like a coherent team. That seems to have all changed quite dramatically following the introduction of Kiefer Moore, who is probably the least likely international hero you could imagine. 6'5" striker, used to be a lifeguard. His first two clubs were Truro City and Dorchester Town. I mean, this guy's come from nowhere, and he's basically changed the way they play, because he's, to put it nicely, a big lump up front. And it means that people like Gareth Bale, Daniel James and Harry Wilson can actually play off him as a reference point now. And he was great again. Kiefer Moore was great again this weekend against Azerbaijan when Wales had to win, and he scored the first goal then. He was great in Slovakia. I was there with them last month, and he scored then too. Basically, when you've got players like James and Bale who can just beat their fullbacks and put crosses in, it helps to have a guy that big. And I remember Peter Crouch, his international goal scoring record was amazing, because basically far-flung small European nations don't know how to deal with these giants. And Kiefer Moore's come in with his swinging elbows and enormous head and just battered teams, basically. And it's given them basically a platform to work from. So, funnily enough, for Giggs trying to spend a year and a half trying to get this fast, free-flowing, all these kids with loads of talent playing, actually, they've been better served by having the big lump up front to work on.
But he does need to be a little bit more clinical. I feel like he wasted
more.
A chance to double the lead. This was just before halftime, I think, or maybe like, I don't know, 10 minutes before halftime or so. He had a great chance that he totally missed. And I actually like the guy in midfield.
Morel.
That's the one.
He had a very good game.
He had a very good game. And I feel like there's been quite a lot of criticism aimed at him playing, but I thought he was really good as well. And you can see, like, I mean, I don't know how to judge this, because, you know, it's Azerbaijan and they never troubled them. Mm-hmm. So you don't know what's going on.
Well, they
there.
Did trouble them a lot when they played them at home a few months ago. Wales are terrible and they won 2-1, but that was like the worst Giggs performance, really. And everyone thought that it was just like,
that was
what's
it,
going
yeah.
on here? So the way they controlled the game compared to then is a big step forward. And they've got Aaron Ramsey coming back in. One of the big issues for Bale, for Wales and Bale, is that Ramsey's basically been missing for the whole campaign. And he's back now, so that
should
help. So
they get it done against Hungary. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, Mina, we've got a lesser-spotted club and international manager. Michael O'Neill has joined Stoke, but he will remain the Northern Ireland manager for their final two games of qualifying. Do you think it's possible to do that job? You're not going to be slightly distracted?
you would be usually, but because it's sort of just, you know, the playoffs, like, you know, that's it. That's all he needs to concentrate on. I think it's obviously a big job for him to take Stoke, you know, and I totally understand why he's not going to say no to that job. I mean, it doubles his salary for one. But he's done such a terrific job with Northern Ireland and taken them so close and had so many amazing nights that I feel like whether he does whether he's a little bit distracted or not, he almost deserves the chance to try it. And you feel like there is a small chance that they could do something special. They've been excellent. They were very unlucky against the Netherlands. And I don't know. I just feel like he deserves this chance to do something if he can do for the playoffs.
He's described it as dead easy to combine the two jobs, which feels a bit like someone talking themselves out of. He's basically saying that actually a job I've been doing for years isn't that difficult. And he essentially said that, you know, you don't need much time to be an international manager because he said they don't have to worry about researching other teams because, frankly, they're not going to play again before we do. So there's time for all that. Which is, I can imagine international managers across the country, across the world, be like, no, shut up. Don't tell anyone how easy it is.
I bet he just delegates everything.
I bet they do a lot of overanalysis, international managers, because there's so little to do during the time. So you're thinking, but what if this happens? And then, like a game of chess, you've got 12 different scenarios and all you actually needed to put a big lad up front and defend behind the ball.
get the rook up top and feed them pawns.
The obvious caveat to what I've just said though is that obviously he's built a structure and a core there and which is, you know, very solid and it's all in place now because he's built that himself. So dipping out of it for a few months.
Surely he'll stick around.
Destroy the machine.
If they sneak into the Euro, surely he'll stick around. Let's turn our attention to the women's game, JJ. A big weekend in the WSL Women's Football Weekend. Two local derbies played at the team's main stadium, Spurs, Arsenal and Liverpool, Everton at Spurs and Anfield, respectively. What was your footballing highlight of the weekend?
I mean, there were some nice goals here and there. Chelsea are top of the league at the moment, and it's been Arsenal for the past 400 years, so that's maybe a little change there. They're only a point ahead, but that's important. I think the highlight would be that the crowds are significantly up. They had 38,262 at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, whatever we call it at the moment.
Naming rights stadium.
Yeah, awaiting naming rights arena.
So that's good. I mean, I was on my way home last night and there was heaps of young kids with their parents, mostly dads, taking them, boys and girls all there. So that seems to be working quite well. I don't know what to say about the highlights.
Feels like a good initiative, Mina. It's done the job of raising publicity for the women's game and it seems like a good timing to do it during an international break.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because sort of, you know, I don't know, 4 years ago, you wouldn't have heard anything about this. But now that all you hear is about the race between them, you know, how many people are going, it's on TV. There's podcasts dedicated to it. There's shows like that, including it more often. There's really like this publicity surrounding it. And actually, it's not a case of no one enjoys this, so we're doing this because, you know, the tickets are cheap or whatever. It seems like people are actually finding the race really exciting to watch and the game's exciting to watch.
It's good that they can play at the big stadiums now as well. Like Chelsea played it at not Stamford Bridge.
Mm-hmm. Kings Meadows.
Kings Meadows. But they have there's a lot of good players like in the Women's Super League. Some of the big stars in the World Cup are there. I mean, look at Chelsea, like Aaron Cuthbert was playing for them. You've got Arsenal's team is basically a list of the best players at the World Cup. So, I mean, that's where you think they get there. And that it's starting to pick up and people will keep going to it, that you will go and see some of the best players in the world at these teams, and that they're there.
The average attendance for the WSL this year is up 313% from last season.
Wow.
Which is big. That's so big because, obviously, a lot of the games this season will be played in men's stadiums. But if you take the men's stadiums out, the average attendance is up by 45%, which is still quite good.
Wow.
Still tidy.
It's now 4,000 average attendance. And also, I think maybe arguably even more sort of telling is that TV figures are also up. So,
and we're talking about it on this podcast. Mm.
Indeed, things are on an upward curve.
The most ringing endorsement of all. Let's turn our attention back to the men's game, which is in a state of stasis in that it remains the most important thing in the world. Premier League returns next weekend. Manchester City versus Chelsea is the obvious pick of the games. Frank Lampard will fancy his chances in this, Mina, you would have thought.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the best time for me, I think, for them to play each other. And I feel like with Chelsea, back in the day, if you had asked me about this in the summer, I would have been like, for sure, that's an easy win for Manchester City. But when you look at this Chelsea side and you look at the control they have in midfield, the movement they have up front, how vertical they can be, how direct they can be, but how determined they are, I feel like they could definitely do something rather good for their team. They can definitely get at least a point in this. But Manchester City, considering what's happened to them, or Liverpool, will have the psychological desire to sort of impose themselves and make sure that everyone knows that who they are, and they are going to be a team that is difficult to beat. I don't think they're very accepting of where they are in the standings right now, and this will be a huge test for them in the sense that they're going to try to prove themselves.
I think City could absolutely do them.
Oh, I think really? That's a definite possibility as well. They'll be so motivated.
I really feel like it's going to be Chelsea.
A few specific reasons for it. Like, I agree that they'll whenever they lose a game like that, they come back hard and they'll be right up for it. If Chelsea play this game in the way that has been going, I love watching Chelsea just now. I saw them against Crystal Palace and thought they were great. I agree with all the things you just said, but there are obvious gaps in transition where they will get pumped by teams like Liverpool and Man City. They'll go straight through the middle of them. They've been playing really well, but not against great teams. And I think what may happen here is if they approach it the same way, and if you think with Lampard, he might approach it in a different way and try and be more defensive because that makes sense. They're away at Etihad, so you'd maybe change the way you play. But it's going so well, why would you try and tinker with it? You go and play in the way that's done well for you. And that is exactly what Pep will have over-analysed. He'll have every single thing worked out to how to get them. The players will be right up for it. And I think this could be something I'd love to see. I really want to see what Frank Lampard does with it.
What about Arsenal, Sam? They're at home to a pretty dreadful Southampton team, or they have been recently. Look at the Arsenal fixtures. They're looking pretty kind until Christmas. Norwich, Brighton, West Ham, Man City. All right, not so easy. Everton and Bournemouth. Do we expect this to be another kind of pulling it back a little bit towards Emery and settling it all down a bit? Because it's been a tumultuous last few weeks for Arsenal.
I think it needs to be. I don't know whether we expect it to be. Based on the last 6 weeks, you wouldn't expect anything, but it certainly needs to be for Emery's sake and, well, for the club's whole ambitions this season. I predict there's going to be some sort of reaction. I think Southampton are there for the taking because they're clearly just a broken team, lacking confidence, but then so are Arsenal, you could argue. But there were signs of improvement, I thought, in the Leicester game when they lost 2-0. And I know they got battered for that. I actually thought, for example, a match of the day, it was really harsh. Like, they picked on Louise, for example, saying, oh, he gave the ball away here. If you actually watch that game, Louise was actually one of Arsenal's best players and he seemed really natural in that back three. So I think they might stick with that. And I think there were signs of progress there for sure. It's just,
if they win 3 in a row, it'll change everything, won't it? All the fans will be suddenly, oh, it's working now.
But realistically, though, when you look at it,
if they say it's 0-0 half time, and you're going to get a lot. And knowing the Emirates, there's going to be a lot of sort of groaning and grumbling, and then he'll substitute Xhaka on. And
they could lose.
Okay, so fast.
You feel like they could win against Norwich or Brighton. I don't know. Potter is good enough. West Ham, well, they still have Roberto, so that's going to be a disaster. Man City, you feel like that'll be a loss. Everton, I feel like,
it's away, so they'll lose that.
Do you see what I mean? And then Bournemouth, which like JJ always tells us. So there we go. So I feel like how many of that can they actually win other than Norwich?
Yeah, I suppose it could very easily go the other way and be the end for them. Anything else, JJ, sticking out to you on the Premier League docket next weekend?
Let me just tell you.
Sheffield United versus Manchester United.
Oh.
That's going to be good.
That's going to be such a fun game because Solskjaer's side now have 5 victories in the past 6 games. You'll see this broken dressing room versus Sheffield United's, amazing Chris Wilder dressing room where everyone just feels really, in sync and loving of one another and whatever it is and determined to play. It's a shame that Dean Henderson will be ineligible.
They're the new Huddersfield, aren't they, Mina? Huh? Are you in love with Sheffield United
I'm
now?
I'm in love with Chris Wilder more than anything else. I don't really care about the team. But I feel like Chris Wilder he's just the perfect coach.
Overlapping centre backs against overpaid centre backs.
Oh, Dino, don't do it. I hope you all saw this over the weekend. Fantastic video of the Nuneaton Borough goalkeeper, Tony Breeden, taking a penalty, smacking it over the bar, and straight onto a light fitting, which fell off the stand and swung around very amusingly. So, my question to you all is, what is the worst set piece you've ever witnessed, and it doesn't have to be a penalty. JJ?
I'll go first.
That is good because I have asked you to go first.
Everyone else said, but there's so many that I see all the time. As people may know, I support Aberdeen Football Club, and most of the set pieces are pretty dreadful. Either a mistake where they don't know what the actual plan is, and it goes out. The only thing I can think of, this morning when I was looking at this, was when I went to see Aberdeen play in a semi-final. I think it was against Dundee United, and Cato Guntveit was doing warm-ups, and his free kick was so bad it hit me in the face.
Oh my God. Mina?
Wasn't there one where someone had to drop their shorts and then it distracted everyone?
I was trying to Google that
for honestly about half an hour yesterday, if you should see my Google searches.
like a basketball psych out.
It was one of those things where everyone turned to look at what the hell happened over there, it was like... But then I remembered the one in the World Cup, Germany against Algeria, when Thomas Müller was running and then tripped. Yeah, do you remember that one?
Yeah, that
and then they were saying, oh, you know, that this is how it was planned, you know, for the pass to be chipped over the Algerian defence, and it just really didn't work out for them, did it?
What have you got, Sam?
The undisputed worst corner in Premier League history, Iago Aspas against Chelsea at Anfield.
Remind us.
Whoa, how could you forget? Okay, this is when Liverpool going for the title, 2014. Mourinho, refusing to be the clown, in his words, turned up at Anfield and basically parked the bus, shut Liverpool down, shut down their title hopes. And with about 5 minutes to go, it's still 1-0. So before Chelsea had made it 2, Liverpool got a corner and it was all, you know, get a goal back and we're in this, the dream's alive. Iago Aspas, Liverpool legend, strolled over to take it in front of the cop. And for some reason, he tried to sort of play it along the ground towards the edge of the box. You know, sometimes when a player like peels out and sort of hits it first time, he just played it straight to Willian, who ran up the other end. And like that, I think that was, might have been his last touch as a Liverpool player, certainly one of them. And it's, I think if you speak to any Liverpool fan or anyone who ever watched that game and just say Iago Aspas, they'll just say that was the corner. That's all he's known for, is a corner. Did an interview actually in which he said, all I'm known for is that corner. So
I'd like to add as well, almost every single free kick Ronaldo took for like a 5-year period, when the excitement would build and he would always smash it straight into someone's chest in the middle of the wall. Why was he always allowed to take them?
I think just proving his contract. Point.
Well, Ramsey's nicking them now.
Did you have one, Tom? You must have one from QPR.
Well, the thing that came to mind for me was there was a period in the first era of Ian Holloway being our manager, because he had a sort of big conversion when he was at Blackpool and decided, oh, I want to be like Barcelona. Football should be about joy. So he cleaned up his act a little bit by the time he came back. But in his first spell, it was quite functional football. And every kickoff we had for about 3 years was the kick to kick off the game, straight back to someone stood on the edge of the centre circle, and then a ball hit as diagonally as far as possible out for a throw-in. So like, yes, get it out within 3 touches. It's like rugby.
Yeah, territory. Yeah.
Well, that's famously the old...
Hearts had that in the cup final last season.
Yeah. Statement of intent.
Famously the old bet on who gets the first throw-in, isn't it?
Oh, I hope you're not accusing anyone of any...
No, no, I'm speaking in general terms.
Division 2 in 2003.
I'm speaking in general terms. I wouldn't put that in any specific player or team.
Good.
The throw-in when Inter conceded, Dortmund got their second from a throw-in. I was trying to think who was the player who let go of the ball. But that was hilarious.
Great story, Mina.
So
you've
been,
Thank you.
I'm sorry. You can cut that part out.
We should also do best set pieces.
Next time.
not now.
That's your lot for this week. You can contact me on Twitter if you want to before next week's show. It's at Tom with an H. Gibbs. Don't forget to send us an email if you'd like to. It's afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. We'll read out the very best of what you send us. Subscribe to the podcast, you know you want to. Telegraph Audio Football Club. Type it in wherever you get your podcast. Hit the relevant button. You'll get it automatically each week. What a treat for you. Thanks to Joel Grove on the buttons, and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.